Right. And I'll mute myself and you have access to the screen anyway. So, right.
Great. So, yeah, I'll get this all set up.
Roger, if you would like to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about the background as well, how you ended up looking at this aspect, that'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me just make sure that I can get this all sorted. And I'll give you, some quick background as well. Right. Perfect. So can you guys see that all right? Okay, cool. Excellent. Yeah. Well, first and foremost, I'd like to thank, I guess, all of you guys for being here, as well as the Global Food Security, kind of this group, for allowing me to come and talk about some of the exciting work that I'm embarking on. My name is Broderick House. I am a first-year PhD student in the Department of Zoology, specifically actually working with David Willer as a co-supervisor with David Aldridge, and we're centered in the Cambridge Conservation Initiative in the David Attenborough building. So I'm really excited to talk to you today and really kind of take you through the work that I'm proposing for my PhD, some of the work and trends that we're seeing, and then hopefully, right by the end of this talk, getting you guys on board to really saying yes to the question of as to whether urban aquaculture of bivalves is an attractive promise for delivering food and economic security. And so with that, I will jump into, there we are. So as that said, just a quick, obviously, the sharing is caring. A lot of the figures in here are being put into a manuscript. So obviously I know we're recording this, but in terms of photos, just share takeaways and hopefully this excitement. But enough of that. Right, so the question is, why food security, which seems maybe kind of a silly question to ask when I'm presenting to the Global Food Security Group. But really, I think we can all appreciate that the current human population is around 7.6 billion currently, and it's expected to grow to 9.8 billion within the next 30 years, which is quite soon. And so not only are we talking about how are we going to sustain life in terms of a food availability, but also when we're looking at present day populations and looking at micronutrients or just kind of nutrition as a whole, we see that over 2 billion people currently, which is about a quarter of the world or the current population, suffer from a micronutrient deficiency. And so what kind of those also entail, for example, are iron. So we have iron deficiencies, vitamin B12, vitamin A. Other ones include calcium and iodine, for example. And so really the question is that because we have this increasing growth in population, how is it that we're going to best support this? Well, I think it's important to first look at, right, how are the current standards of trying to address this question. And that's really from an agricultural standpoint and production. And I think hopefully we can all appreciate that it's not sufficient, or it will not be a sufficient model for providing the needs necessary, at least at this point in stage. And so if you look at this, this is kind of the production over the last 60 years and its increase in edible weight of agricultural. And this is the latest data from the FAO, or the Food and Agriculture Organization. And right, so you can see here is listed kind of the main products here, which are chicken, pork, cattle, and gray, a cereal, which is kind of clumped, just different grains such as wheat, barley, et cetera, and then corn. So you can see that overall, there is this general uptick in terms of the production that we have globally, which is great. But as we also understand that there's quite a bit of problems that come with agricultural farming as a whole. And some of these are uses of fertilizer and pesticides. We see biodiversity loss, as well as deforestation, disease within a lot of livestock populations. A big one is no effluent control, or a lot of the waste, right? The runoff from this in terms of using water, a lot of these things in terms of the climate as well. And not helping the climate crisis in this regard. And a lot, we also see a lot of soil stripping in that manner. But I think one of the biggest things that even if we do develop new technologies to try and address better fertilizers or using less pesticides or more organic pesticides, is that the reality is that farmland is finite. And so, right, we, as a population that's growing, we need room to live, we need room to do a lot of things. And so agricultural farming actually does take up quite a bit of space. And so with that in mind, a lot of the agriculture or the farming industry and scientists and researchers and farmers alike have really kind of turned to this idea of aquaculture, which is really farming in the ocean or farming in bodies of water, which allows for the expansion of farming beyond the agricultural space or the land-based type of conventional farming. And so these foods are known as blue foods. And so the Global Seafood Alliance, kind of their definition of blue food is really just any edible aquatic organism, including fish, shellfish, algae, from marine or freshwater production systems. And so the FAO categorizes these blue foods into kind of three main categories, which will be important for moving on and kind of looking at some figures later on in my talk. But hopefully we can all appreciate, or maybe we've seen something similar to this picture here, maybe at a seafood restaurant or at a market and whatnot. And so in terms of how the FAO again categorizes these things that we're seeing here, we have crustacea, so lobsters, our prawns, our shrimp. there's also finfish. And then we have these little guys in the corner, also known as mollusks. And so when looking at blue foods and trying to say, okay, if we're going to say, in terms of addressing the production of more high protein resources or high protein foods that also are trying to tackle micronutrient deficiencies and these demands that really are being placed on the food system and the population as it's growing, I think it's important to say, well, what are the actual nutritional values of these things, as opposed to just saying, okay, let's just ditch land and go into the water. And so when you look at the actual nutritional profiles of these main agriculture and main aquaculture products, you actually find that the aquaculture products outperform the agriculture. And so what I've done here is shown kind of the nutritional profiles of, again, those top kind of meat-based agriculture products. So we have beef, chicken, and pork here. And so if you look at the protein, it's quite high. And this is all based off of, these are all normalized to a 100 gram portion size. and you see roughly around 100, 180, and 134. But when you look at the aquaculture equivalents in terms of the highest produced or farmed finfish, which is salmon, crustacea, lobster, and then mollusks or bivalves, oysters, clam, and mussel, you see that actually their protein is very similar or just as competitive to those being grown on land. And then, right, so the protein, having a high protein based kind of product for individuals for a healthy diet is important, but also, right, we also established that a quarter of the world's population are currently micronutrient deficient. And so looking at those as well, again, those iron, the vitamin B12, vitamin A, we see that beef, chicken, and pork are actually relatively low in those in comparison to our aquaculture products. And specifically, actually, right, the question is, what do we do and what is the most sustainable and what is the best kind of use of aquaculture scaping? And so again, right, so the question is are bivalves a potential solution? And so if you look specifically at oysters, clams, and mussels, you'll see that they are extremely high in iron, zinc, vitamin B12, and vitamin A, and also very high in protein. And so this is really exciting because they're much smaller. They do have, there's a wide variety of them as well. And so this is what I think really has made them an exciting venture to look at as well. And so I guess I keep saying bivalve. And so I guess what even is a bivalve, right? So we might be familiar with that, but in kind of a short context, a bivalve is an aquatic mollusk, which has a compressed body enclosed within a hinged shell is kind of the basic generic definition for this. But I'm sure we are all familiar with mussels, clams, and oysters being kind of the main source of bivalves in everyday diet. Of course, this also extends to scallops as well. And so, right, if we look at the standard aquaculture that's being presented today, in terms of like that original photo that I showed, where we see kind of the fish being farmed or bivalves in terms of ropes and things like that, there are actually quite a few pros that come with it. One of which being that it's a carbon sink, right? So the ocean is a natural carbon sink for the CO2 that's being produced in the world. And so the shellfish actually use that CO2 to help build their shells. Furthermore, the ocean provides food, right? So there's a natural kind of food supply that is constantly being given over the course of the development of these bivalves. Also, there's high marine availability. So when looking at the ocean, there's much more space that you can look at in terms of where you're looking, coastal regions, things like that. Again, low land use. So this prevents the stripping of soil and things like that. There's also low input costs overall, because essentially what you're doing in terms of bivalve farming is you're seeding in terms of either a bag or ropes, different kind of methods like that. And then you're allowing them to grow and you're kind of leaving them be and allowing the ocean to feed them. And then when they're at full market size value, which is roughly about 2 to 3 years, you can harvest and take them to market. With that, also there's a low maintenance and, you know, no very minimal cleaning in terms of the actual process. So these are some of the strong pros for aquaculture as a whole. And so because of that, we wanted to look at, well, what is the global edible weight of aquaculture, right? So if it is this blue food that does provide high protein, promises with high micronutrient rich kind of forms of food, then are we seeing an increase in that? And we are seeing an increase somewhat, but again, actually in terms of bivalves, we're not really seeing too much. So the FAO, again, demonstrates that offshore is considered marine and onshore is freshwater. And that's how it'll be presented for the rest of this talk. But you can see that the production in comparison to cattle and pork and of the like is much, much higher than the production of even just aquaculture here. but with that, even so, your mollusks are a very small proportion of the actual aquaculture being produced, with fin fish being the largest volume here. And that's more so onshore fin fish as well. So with that, kind of teasing these apart, I wanted to look at, are bivalves as a whole even being kind of looked at in terms of their onshore potential, but then also what are they in their offshore, and really just trying to understand what is the market, what are people in terms of food security using bivalves for. And so you can see that in terms of marine, well, in freshwater instances, there's none, but also in marine sense, there are none being grown on land. But then when we look at obviously offshore or marine production of bivalves, there is a higher percentage, but again, fin fish still pretty much dominate that production. And so this is a very, I think, crucial kind of point in terms of, if we're looking at food security and we're looking at ways to provide, again, a very high protein rich, high micronutrient like options for providing the population, the global population, with such a food, that's also going to require quite a bit in terms of looking at the marine. And the reason why we've specifically looked at marine is because, as you can tell here, the salt water or the salinity in terms of the production of bivalves actually provides a higher palatability. So consumers are much more interested in the taste of saltwater-based bivalves as opposed to the freshwater, right? And so we see that in the demand, which there's very low demand for freshwater-based bivalves. And so this got us thinking, right, in terms of maybe a potential to say, well, how could we farm or provide a high enough level of bivalves to kind of help support this system. And so again, looking at the overall kind of landscape of bivalve aquaculture, I hope you can appreciate here that China is the largest. And again, this is, I guess I should also clarify that this is specifically marine for the aforementioned reasons, but China is actually the largest contributor to the output of bivalves with approximately 83% of the production. And then it drastically drops off down to about 2% for a few other countries, and then 1%. And so right, in terms of looking at the rest of the globe, right, if you're trying to understand how can this be a viable option for providing a resource or food security for the rest of the population, something needs to change. And that has been the thought and the process of considering, well, what if we, instead of using aquaculture in its traditional sense of using it in the ocean, rather we moved it into kind of these regions that are less than 1%, which is a landlocked territory, right? So I think a lot of us can appreciate that if you go to the middle of a landlocked region and somebody is offering you seafood, your first thought is, well, it's probably not fresh, it's probably frozen, it's probably gone through some sort of processing, I don't want it. Or they say, if you want really good clam chowder, go to the ocean, right? If you want the best fish and chips, you go to the ocean, because you want to be as close to the source as possible. And so again, this is really brought the idea to kind of the front of saying, well, what is the potential for potentially growing in an urban sense or urban aquaculture of these marine bivalves? And so again, this then says, well, then if you have all of these pros for standard aquaculture, well, why would we now, right? I've just kind of gone through this whole list of why we shouldn't use land, and agriculture is, you know, kind of deforestation and things like that. So then it really brought us to the forefront of looking at standard aquaculture and, well, what are the cons? What is the market entry, or what is that catalyst that's going to say that we should look at bringing aquaculture back onto land in a marine sense? And so some of these cons actually, right, tie back to the agricultural landscape, and that you see with bivalves being extremely good filter feeders, we see that there's the potential for contamination of trace metals. So we see cadmium, we see mercury and a lot of heavy metals. So bivalves actually filter these heavy metals and store them in their tissues. And so then by us consuming them, we then effectively are just taking a very high intense pill of these heavy metals. Not only that, but there's also organochlorines, there's also microbial contamination, right? So because you're growing it in the open ocean, you have to deal with then the possibility of bacteria, whether that's from untreated human waste being released by, you know, local or nearby rivers and things like that, that bacterial population is gonna be stored in those, as well as then algal blooms, right? As we're seeing with increasing temperatures in terms of the climate, and increasing ocean temperatures as well, algal blooms are becoming much more common. And so with that comes a lot of biotoxins, you know, so that's where we're seeing paralytic shellfish poisoning, diuretic neurotoxins, and all of those things, which unfortunately, in terms of post farming, you can't get rid of. Not to mention then eutrophication from the ocean in terms of farming techniques, again, release of chemicals. In terms of the harvesting of these bivalves, there's a lot of displacement of bird and seal populations. So now you're talking about ecological disturbances. You're also then, right, in terms of collecting seed for hatcheries and things like that, you still see an impact on those. And so then that really drives the fact that we need to invest in proactive solutions. Right. So again, aquaculture in the ocean in terms of bivalves seems like a very good opportunity because, right, again, it's a high protein, high micronutrient rich. But when you're looking at the actual kind of detriment to health and these types of things, you know, we want to invest in something that actually is going to try and help address the problem, not just be a temporary solution. And so that's really what brought us to the idea, all of this, hopefully, as you're following along, to the idea of, well, urban aquaculture. And so really playing urban aquaculture versus standard aquaculture methods, we wanted to look at, you know, well, what are the pros to, instead of growing in the ocean, growing in a facility, right? And so these pros include year-round harvesting, right? So you can grow them at any point of the year. You're not relying upon the ocean and different currents and different times of the year to be better than others, right? You negate a lot of the kind of the toxins, like, right, algal blooms generally occur in the summer months. So this also then provides a year-round production of produce. You can control your waste and effluents, right? So unlike agricultural standpoints where you can use fertilizer or where they use fertilizers and pesticides and things like that, and you can't control the runoff, with this, because you know the water that you're using, you know the things that you're putting into your system, you also know exactly what's going out. And so you have a much more aware, you have higher awareness for what is being released. Also control of disease, right? The benefits of growing in a facility is that you can actually be, like you can see in this image on the right, you can actually see your populations that you're growing, and you can touch them, you can do tests, you can see them exactly the way they are, you can monitor them. And so if there's any sign of disease, you can address it quickly. With that, again, right, there's low water testing, so you can just reach in, you can take the water, you can test it for different things, different viruses, bacteria, things like that. Another great impact is that there's no importation, right? So you could say New York City could have a facility, or different places in urban settings within New York City or London or in Kenya or Nigeria, right? Those areas can actually have their own facilities to grow this. So you're not having to say, well, this is being flown in from the ocean, or it's being imported from another country. It really does feed back into that system. Again, in terms of any sort of disease or any kind of issues that may arise, it's traceable because you're doing it within a facility. It's not saying, well, it came from this ocean region. We're not really sure where this toxin came from or why it slipped into the market. You would know exactly where it came from. Again, I think the idea or what is really exciting about the focus of this is, right, really reusing developed urbanized spaces. So taking those abandoned places, or trying to take into account, right, space that's already been urbanized and reusing it and repurposing it to be able to be a facility for this, as opposed to, again, kind of deforestation and whatnot in terms of the sustainability approach. Another great thing about urban aquaculture is that you can have high biosecurity. So a big reason, right? So I know I already mentioned that in terms of interest, people generally gravitate towards marine bivalves for their source, right? Again, for the salinity, the palatability, how it tastes. But by bringing saltwater creatures into mainland, where there's fresh water predominantly, that if there's any kind of spawn that are released into the environment by on accident, they won't survive. And so you don't have to worry about accidentally introducing an invasive species into a new territory, because again, it's surrounded by fresh water. And another thing in terms of facilities and things like that, in terms of economic security, you're talking about the production of a facility that's going to require jobs. And so that also kind of spawns those needs as well. Right, but like anything, there are also cons. And so I think it's also, right, when we were looking at this, what are the potential cons that can come from urban aquaculture? One of them is continuous monitoring, right? So unlike the ocean, where it does all of the feeding, it does all the monitoring, you're going to have to employ people, which is going to cost money. You're going to have to provide a continuous food supply, which again, is a pretty is a need that is going to cost money. Continuous energy supply to make sure pumps are running, to make sure things are flowing, the lights stay on, all of that stuff. And again, I think the biggest thing is that when looking at these continuous aspects, the reality is that at the present moment, it has to be continuous for 2 to 3 years before you even see your first output, right? So that's kind of the barrier to entry with this, is that you're going to invest all of this money and you're going to have to wait 2 to 3 years to see that. And again, right, continuous maintenance and cleaning as well. So these are the biggest cons in terms of trying to do urban aquaculture. and so I know I've been kind of talking a lot about all of these things. So I wanted to quickly just kind of give a visual representation of what this would look like, right? So you'd have in your facility an urban, in your kind of urban scape, if you will, you'd have a tank that has, in this case, some oysters, right? And the challenge is that you have all of these things, right? The cost, as I just went through, you have to feed them continuously, energy and maintenance has to go into this. But what hopefully we can appreciate is that the kind of the return of investment is an increase in food safety. Not only do you get that, but you can get high value products. So you can grow things like pearls, and there's other high value market aspects that also can be sold. It's not just for the meat itself. And then ideally what I'm looking at as well is trying to design a system where we can do polyculture. So you could grow it with different, maybe mussels and oysters growing together, or seaweeds or algae and things like that, to again, diversify what could actually be sold, what could be used in a nutritious sense, but also what could be used in an economic sense. Again, right, we have the control of waste agriculture. Some individuals in our lab are looking at ways to kind of have a circular economy. So the shells that nobody eats or uses, how do we use those potentially for agricultural purposes? And again, right, what I've been suggesting here in terms of the food and nutrition benefits. So I think to kind of sum all of this up and kind of wrap it all together to say the future potential of urban of aquaculture, hopefully I've shown to you, is quite promising. And that's not to say that standard aquaculture doesn't have potential, future potential as well. It does provide a hope for increasing global food production. It also increases jobs and also integration of high protein food sources. But hopefully what you can appreciate as well is that in terms of looking at urban aquaculture, we see a vast increase, right? So again, similar things, increase in global food production, increased jobs, integration of high protein food source, but we see also production of high value products, decreased health hazards, the potential for polyculture, decreased transport, blue farming. And I think what's one of the exciting things is, right, extending blue farming to landlocked regions as well. And so, yeah, so again, to tie all of this up, kind of the future directions that this work will be looking into is kind of validating the growth of bivalves in a lab environment or in an urban setting, how to optimize the growth to market size, how to decrease that 2 to 3 year, because that is kind of the biggest entry or barrier that we're seeing right now, as well as how to optimize the input to output ratio. How can we put in as little money or food as possible and get the most food out, and then also just kind of designing prototypes and marine aquaculture systems, and hopefully then speaking with policymakers and communities to really see what the actual fit for this is. And so with that, I'd like to thank obviously my group, David Willer, my co-supervisor, David Aldridge, my other co-supervisor, also the Herbert Lee, Reed Lab, who's been very helpful in trying to understand aquatic or marine-based circular systems, as well as the CCI, my funding, I'm a Harding Distinguished Postgraduate Scholar, as well as then obviously Cambridge, and then you guys at the Global Food Security. And so with that, let's see if it'll go to the last slide. It's not happy. It just says questions. So I'm happy to take any questions right now.
Thank you, Roderick.
Oh, there it goes.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you so much. Yes, we saw the last slide. Thank you so much.
Perfect.
It was a very clear presentation. I have a very quick question then. I mean, given the pros of the traditional aquaculture, bivalve aquaculture, and the cons of the urban one, would it be too optimistic to think that perhaps we could tackle the problems listed in the cons of the traditional aquaculture and, you know, sort of focusing on that more than investing in urban aquaculture, given the costs associated with it?
Yeah, so I think that's it's a really great question. And in terms of, I think, right, my hope is that this isn't like a ditch one and jump on the other, right? I think that especially in terms of looking at climate, I mean, I think that's a huge driver here, right? As well as saying, if you're going to look at these downsides in terms of pesticides, these runoffs, I mean, that's a big thing that we're seeing, right? Is that increase with climate change. I mean, we're seeing that oceans are becoming more acidic, which actually is helping heavy metals dissolve into the ocean water even more so than they were before. So, and as currents are changing and things like that, I think that's something that should be addressed in terms of standard aquaculture. So how do we make better pesticides that are maybe more of an organic or kind of more natural kind of setting and things like that to help kind of take those cons off that list. But I think at the same time, at the rate at which the oceans are changing and all of these things are still accumulating and that we're not really at a point of stripping again the chemicals, the microplastics, things like that out of the ocean yet, that I think there is benefit in terms of looking at ways to provide urban aquaculture. And I think the biggest way as well is then highlighting that that benefit is not just kind of for the privileged on those coastal regions, but saying, okay, we can also bring that high protein nutrient rich food to then landlocked regions as well. So
Yeah. No, but given the also the map that you showed us, there's so many countries that despite the coast don't really seem to really bank on the bulb bulbs that they could really grow, then that would be an incentive in a way, right? Mm-hmm. But enough for me. I've got a few more questions, but I'll let others to ask questions and make comments. Please, would anyone have a comment or a question? John, and then Martin.
I'll take this off because it always interferes with...
John, if you'd like to say where you're from, be nice for Roderick to know, to get to know you.
Oh, there you are.
You are muted.
No, we can hear you. We can hear you, John.
Forget it.
I think we can hear you, John.
John, we could hear you. I think he can hear us, okay. Maybe.
He can't hear us.
Maybe not. Should we go on to Martin? Martin, would you like to ask a question? Then perhaps John might be able to join us again.
Thanks, Boric. As you know, I'm an archaeologist. Thanks, Boric, for a great talk. That was really interesting. And I can really see the advantages of going inland at the same time as intensifying on the coast. And what I wondered was how far inland in terms of water availability. And that's a completely ignorant, uninformed question. So, for example, I don't even know whether you could do these inland systems with a recycling system or not. So I'm very ignorant on what the water needs are. So I assume at one stage of really inland in the continents, water availability gets a bit of a problem, but I just wonder where and what and around that.
Yeah. No, I think that's an excellent question. And it's one that, Rit, I've been speaking with quite a few aquariums and like I said, James's lab here, to kind of tackle that question as a whole of saying, well, if you're going to try and do salt water in a landlocked region, there's not really salt water available. So how do you overcome that? And so it's actually, there's a process, which is creating reverse osmosis water. And then you manually add the salt in to create kind of an artificial salt water. So there is food grade salt that you can use in that kind of process. And so that's, again, one of the benefits. And that's why in terms of health hazards or the decrease in health hazards is with that reverse osmosis, the membrane for filtering that water across to make it pure actually is small enough to really get rid of most microbes, so bacteria, as well as heavy metals, as long as the levels are low. So if you're using tap water, those levels are pretty low anyways. And it's also small enough for to get rid of microplastics as well, which now we're obviously, that's a whole nother topic that we're starting to see on the rise with just everything else. So in that regard, if that answers your question, it's really looking at using tap water and salinifying it to create
that. And then you probably could recycle it. I mean, at a certain stage, tap water is a limited resource, isn't it? But in some systems, then the tap water just, you know, it's a linear thing.
Yeah.
And in other systems, you can keep the water within the system, which allows you. If you couldn't keep the water within the system, then on a global level, it becomes essentially inland littoral bands that it's cost effective.
Yeah, and so that is one of the things that looking at this, I think a beautiful aspect is aquaponics. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but essentially it's hydroponics, so growing plants with water, and aquaculture, so growing obviously farming fish in water. It's kind of the general use, but aquaponics brings the two together such that you have a closed loop system. So the wastewater from your fish feeds your plants, the plants clean the water, and you can put that water back in. Right. But the challenge is that I would have to look for crops that grow in salt water, like ocean water, right? So that's kind of then where the idea of polyculture, or definitely down the line, maybe you could have a tank system that has seaweed, and what would then the cleaning benefits of that be? So that's definitely its own area of research, or trying to see if there is some sort of symbiotic kind of tank setup that you could have that could do a similar manner, so that you can kind of have that closed loop system that doesn't need a ton of water changing or exchange, because you're exactly right. If that's the case, if you have to remove half your water a couple of days a week or once a week, then on a global scale, that turns into a lot of water waste, which we're already seeing as a challenge.
Yeah. It's not sustainable at that point. John was asking what you can do then with the shells. What sort of use do they have?
Yeah. So it's interesting. So some of our lab, there's a member of our lab who's kind of looking at a circular economy. So how can shells potentially be used for different heavy metal stripping, looking at ways to kind of clean water or use them as a filter to try, right? Because again, shells have unique properties with the way that they're built, that they can actually capture different types of fertilizer. So he's looking at a lot of ways to do that, such that, you know, the shells, if you're saying, okay, we're going to produce in mass these bivalves, what do you do with the shells? So then you could take those shells and potentially use them for agricultural purposes in that capacity to try and help, again, soak up some of those wastes that we're seeing in runoff in streams and things like that downstream from agricultural land. Yeah.
Thank you, John. Anyone else has any questions or comments?
A question, if I may.
Chris.
What sort of food and how much food would you need to get useful quantities of protein by this method?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the answer is that that's part of kind of what I'm also trying to figure out, right, is how much, I think it would be a really interesting approach to look at, right, how much protein is being produced per time, per space versus then, you know, beef or pork or things like that as you're talking as well. What I will know from what I do, or what I will say from what I do know, is that actually my co-supervisor who's here, David Willer, he showed at least in terms of touching back on bivalves and their filtration process, right? So it's kind of negative in terms of heavy metals and bacteria and viruses, they kind of cling on to that. But what he managed to do was, what our group also showed was that they kind of exploited that for vitamin fortification. And so they were able to actually fortify bivalves. They did it with vitamin A and vitamin D as kind of a proposal. But what they found was that they were able to do it in such a way that you only needed to eat two mussels or two bivalves in order to get more than enough of your daily value. So if you do it with that kind of a thing, you're talking, right, you only need a couple. If you're really actually interested in that as well, David Willer is also looking much more into kind of the nutritional aspect of things in terms of how it is in a system. So he's now looking at how do we get uptake of bivalves and interest in bivalves such that they can be put into either kind of the raw form that we're used to where it's in shell or in kind of a way of, can we like mask it in terms of products that are kind of like fish cakes and things like that, right? So that then you're talking, you could add some, you know, a very small amount of these fortified bivalves into a fish cake, for example, and you're getting more than your daily amount for whatever nutrients are deficient in those regions because you can tailor it in that way. So I hope that addresses your question to some extent.
And also are you just going to be ending up shipping thousands of tons of agricultural product to cities to produce hundreds of kilos of protein?
Yeah, so I'm looking at using kind of algae as a feed, algae. Right? So that's my current. So that is one of the challenges, right, with fortifying is the way they do that is with a feed that has been created. So in terms of sustainability, right, that is going to be limited to higher end or higher resource cities or urban environments who can afford to ship that in. But I'm looking at that is part of the research that I'll be doing is looking at how to grow algae and then are there different feeds that you could potentially use that are low cost mm-hmm. to kind of boost things.
Thank you.
Looks like. Yeah, thank absolutely. You, Chris.
David has probably something to say.
No, it's a quick question from me, Broderick. Obviously this sounds like a really great option. But it's quite a busy space in that there are lots of different industries and lots of different areas of research looking at alternative proteins for the future, whether it's insects, whether it's algae, whether it's different types of plant-based crops through genetic engineering. How do bivalves stack up against that? And why should we be investing, you know, lots of money and scientific effort into bivalves as opposed to pouring it into crop research or insect research, for example?
Yeah, well, I think as, it is a good question. Again, I think we can appreciate things such as golden rice and other kind of plant-based fortified materials have been ventured out, right? But then that's the challenge is that then you're creating a monoculture. And again, in terms of agricultural space, you're using that kind of agricultural land, which again is, as I mentioned, is a little bit more finite. And so I think that in terms of looking at least this is, my understanding, the reason why bivalves really do stack up against these types of things is again, because it's an actual natural meat source, which is still very important for bio availability, right? So when you're looking at micronutrients, the best way to absorb them is through some sort of bioavailable method. That's why vitamin tablets aren't necessarily the best because they don't come in that form. So, right. So crops and other things like that are going to have to be, they're going to be additive in terms of that, or they just won't simply supply the micronutrients that bivalves have to offer. At least that would be my response to that.
But also, you know, I think the great aspect of the bivalves is also the minerals and the vitamins that they offer. We seem to focus a lot on proteins and perhaps even too much, in my view, given that it is reasonably easy to take the recommended daily intake of proteins in many ways, but I think the advantage of the bivalves is they offer some vitamin B and A and iron, etc. So I think that's certainly something to focus on, as well as the proteins, of course. But
as a caveat on that point, one of the key reasons that bivalves are so rich in iron, selenium, zinc, B12, etc., is because they filter it from the water. If you're doing bivalves in an urban environment where you're controlling the water quality, you need to factor that into your design. Otherwise, you lose a lot of the micronutrient benefits of bivalves simply because you don't have the seawater.
And that's definitely a good point. And I think I'll need to double check, but I believe at least the salt that I've been looking at, that I know that James's lab uses, I think comes with it, is supposed to be kind of like to create the seawater. I haven't double checked the mineral levels, I guess, at that level, but I do believe it is supposed to be kind of more of a complete salt package for that. So that would, but that is still a good point to look, especially using reverse osmosis, which obviously from the tap water and things like that will remove those things that stuff gets supplemented back in.
So that's interesting. It would lose a lot of the nutrients at this point. Anyone else before we wrap up and close?
I just mentioned,
you also put some links.
I put some links in the chat for when you're getting fed up with the day job and you want distractions. and the first one's obvious. It's just about those Japanese shellmans. The second one is actually a site on the North German coast in the kind of, roughly 2000 years ago, that sort of period, there was quite a lot of agriculture pushing into the salt marshes. And as I remember, it's a long time since I read it, Feathers and Beard, which is the site I mentioned, barley was the crop that you could really push into some pretty saline situations. Okay. But anyway, they're more for amusement and distraction than anything else.
Because we could look at Norfolk and the marshes in Norfolk.
Yeah. I mean, the great thing about going back to that period is that they weren't managed salt marshes. They were literally getting crops going in pretty raw salt marsh.
Yeah. Martin, actually, I have a question for you now that you've made this comment. How much actually your work in archaeology is really taken into account when strategy are planned for future growing of crops, whatever? Do they really look at the past?
There's much more interest in it now. I mean, I think there was collectively, we went through a peak of having a very mechanistic focus of an idea of But I think there was the idea of a singular optimal solution to a lot of these problems, wasn't it? And I think generally there's, or just the existence of our group is a good example. There's an awareness that looking laterally in various directions is important. What's really important about the group, you know, I mean, I just want to comment. Another point, which I think is really interesting about Boric's work is the ownership and the rights to the production is much simpler to affect inland. I mean, although from our talk a few weeks back, we're aware that the offshore zone is could have phenomenal importance. The kind of land rights to that and ownership and rights are going to be an absolute nightmare when it becomes significant. So to actually own inland plots of land is going to be a great advantage in following up what Broderick was talking about.
That's true. That's a very good point.
Do we have anyone in the group with expertise about rights and legalities? Do we have anybody in our discussion?
I've been trying to bring in a couple of people from the law department, despite having done in my master's in there, and that's how I landed in Cambridge. They are still not really into the group, so hopefully we will manage to have a couple of experts from the area, because I completely agree, and obviously it's an area that is fundamental. Likewise, trade, you know, and economics, we can't forget those aspects. Anyone else or Broderick, would you like to make some final observations?
I think it's been fantastic. It's always great to kind of share thoughts or meet people from different backgrounds, and I think I've jotted a lot of notes down to take into consideration, so I hope to present again in the future and kind of update you on the progress and see that kind of stuff as well. So again, thank you so much, and
thank you.
It's been a pleasure, so thank you. I'm excited
thank
to be
you.
A part of
thank you.
Part of the group.
Despite the good weather, I'm giving up an hour of your time, so
yeah.
Thank you everyone. I have a good weekend, and I will see you next Friday, hopefully, for our last seminar before the Easter break.
Sounds great.
Great. Bye. Have a good weekend.